Hi, my name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic and addict. And I was thinking about shouting, so I wouldn't have to use this thing because I hate the sound of my own voice. And I'm desperately trying to think of things to say. I wasn't nervous until 10 seconds ago. And now I have no idea what I'm going to talk about, but I'll be watching the clock like a fanatic. I came here about, I've been told I was here. A while ago, I can't even, what was it, you say six, seven?
Nine.
Nine. Can't believe it. It's gone by in such a flash. And Gary, who was a mate of mine from another mate, brought me here. And as it is now, I was completely overwhelmed by the size of the meeting. I go to a local meeting in Guildford where I come from, and it's about maybe about a third of the size of this. And I know everybody in the room, and we've all been sort of on the same road for quite a while. And I know Ian because he collared me to come here tonight. And I know a couple of other people, I think. But in a way, it's sort of, in some ways, it's quite refreshing to talk to a crowd of people who I know are sober. And they have some point of reference, but I don't really know who you are or what you do or anything. And the funny thing is, I don't know who they are either. I share this room and my path in recovery with these other people in Guildford. I have no idea what their last names are. I don't know what they do. Unless they come and kind of introduce themselves for some other purpose, and that has happened, and then I kind of get the hairs go up on the back of my neck, you know. Because I stopped feeling safe then. The reason I love these rooms and this fellowship and the 12-step program is because I can just be like you, and I don't have any worth to you other than the fact that I am staying sober and like you one day at a time. I don't have any notion about length of time. I get just as screwed up today as I did on my second day of recovery. I have the same nightmarish thoughts. I've got a hateful, malevolent personality, which you know, I plot. I'm a plotter, and I have a young family now. I got married again about 16 years ago. We started raising kids, and I have three young girls, teenagers, and I plot against them constantly, and because I can never get it right, needless to say, and they're going through their they're the worst part of their lives, really, where everything's sort of changing. They don't know who they are, what they're supposed to be doing, what to wear. They're desperately trying to have boyfriends, not to have boyfriends, not to admit that they've already got boyfriends or whether they have sex. And you know, our bedrooms are quite close together. They all got their own bedrooms. They're listening to Drake, they're listening to Stormzy, they're listening to Kanye. And I have to kind of monitor this stuff. And my daughter said, well, you like Drake, you know, and I thought, well, I'll buy the album and I'll check it out. And, you know, the first time I heard, fuck you, no, don't. And it was, you know, every 10 seconds there was another obscenity. And I swore a lot as an addict and a drunk. I swore all the time because I thought it was funny, because I thought it expressed my emotions and to attract attention, to hurt people, everything you can think of. I don't swear anymore. Very rarely do I swear. And when I first came into these rooms, I swore a lot. And I liked people who swore a lot. And I used to go to, at the early days of my recovery, I used to go to an ACAO meeting in Notting Hill, top of Portobello Road. And there was a guy who was my hero in there. Absolutely wonderful guy, who would just let rip. And he would lay into his family and his life. And I think his mum was a hooker, his dad was a dealer, and it was just a nightmare. And I loved him. I thought he was the most powerful personality I'd ever come across. And I was terrified of him, absolutely terrified of him. But in that room, I knew I was all right, because it wasn't gonna be directed at me, it was directed at his higher power, I don't know, but the room, I knew we were all safe, and that it was, what blew me away was it was okay for him to be like that, And sure enough, I went up to him at the end of the meeting. He was a teddy bear. Absolute, you know, butter could melt in his mouth. And I thought, well, this is really, this is the kind of nth degree of what I need from recovery. Is and I really principally am a member of AA, and I won't go on about that. I know this is secular, if we can use that word. But so, but I did need to go all that way into recovery to hear people go crazy. For me to know that it was safe everywhere inside the rooms, you know. And I also remember going to my first meeting of ACOA was over in the Hospital of Rare Tropical Diseases somewhere in North London. And there was a little room with about eight people in it. And it was an hour meeting and I couldn't get a word in. Just when they were going to call the end of the meeting, near to the end, this woman, she knew it was nearly time, she started to share, and I could see time running out, and I thought I was busting to say, I didn't know what I was going to say, and she stopped just before, you know, the 58th minute, and the chairman, the secretary said, is there anyone got a real desire to share, and, you know, and I said, yes, and I want to say, I fucking hate women. And I thought, where did that come from? And I thought, oh no, they're gonna take me outside and hang or shoot me or what? I've said what I really mean, and I didn't know that I felt that way. I really didn't know it was in there, resident, and it came out. And I just thought I was just limp with shame, and. I was just weak. I was burned out by just saying that. And this lady was a kind of militant-looking lady in camo and everything. And she said, thanks for saying that. What is this, you know? And I thought, well, this is great because it means that anything goes. Anything goes. And I remember being hypnotized off of cigarettes. I mean, I hypnotherapy myself off it, not myself. I went to see someone who did it, and I just thought, well, because I had met a girl. I'm going all over the place here. You don't mind, do you? No, I don't think you do. I mean, it's really all related, believe me. I'd met a girl in the rooms in New York that I desperately wanted to like me, and I really fancied her, and I wanted her to fancy me, all that kind of stupid stuff. And she didn't like people that smoked. And I was smoking 60 a day at the time. And she wouldn't let me smoke in her apartment. She didn't like me when we went out. I took her out to dinner, didn't like that. So I knew I wasn't going to get anywhere at all. So I just, and I started praying. So I started praying for the idea of thinking about giving up smoking. And so I gradually kind of crept up on it like that. And sure enough, I went to a sort of sober dinner party with a mate that you'd all know if I said his name, but I'm not going to say his name. But anyway, he introduced me to someone at that dinner party. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I shouldn't have asked that, but I did. And he said, I'm a hypnotherapist. I said, do you do smoking? And he said, I do Parkinson's disease. I mean, he had a very, very wide spectrum of consultation practices. And I said, well, can you help me? And he said, I'll see you Monday morning. So I went over to this place near Regent's Park. It was the Hale Clinic, I think it was called. And I'm sitting in there, this isn't going to work. I was just completely negative about it and skeptical. And we started talking. He said, I'm now going to put you into trance. He said, count backwards from 100. And I don't remember anything else. You know, to this day, I don't know how it worked. But I was semi-conscious. And part of my brain was saying, keep your eyes closed, even though it's hard work, because you don't want to hurt his feelings. I really didn't want to hurt his feelings. So I kind of pretended that I was hypnotized. And he said to me, this is a powerful thing for me to talk about, because I always get emotional when I think about it. He said, I want you to think of the worst time in your life. I want you to go to the most shameful, painful part of your life now and tell me about it. And I said, okay, I'm in the schoolyard and I'm crying. and I don't know why. And I feel it now. And he said, well, I want you to pick up that little boy and hold him in your arms and say, everything's going to be all right. And I did. And when I sort of, when I came to out of this, I don't remember where else. He did this thing, it's a practical thing where he cut connection so that the phone rang, I didn't immediately want to pick up. If I had sex, I didn't immediately want to. If I got excited, whatever. We tried to sever. And I came to him and he said, well, and I said, well, thanks very much. And he said, how long do you think you've been here? And I said, about half an hour. And he said, you've been here for 3 hours. And I didn't, you know, all I can remember is that surge, that powerful moment, and which took me right into my being. And I started to learn really how to help myself recover. I was going off to rehearsals and down in Bray, over near Windsor. And I was driving from Regent's Park to there, and I saw a good-looking girl walk. It was in Knightsbridge. I saw this girl walk by, and I went to the glove compartment, and I didn't. And I remember what I'd learned in here. One day at a time, if I could get to bed that night, and I knew this, absolute certainty, it was over. And I stayed, I didn't have a fag until I went to bed, and I haven't had a cigarette since. And I'm so fucking proud of that, because I was helped a great deal to get sober and well and straight. But that one thing I did with the use of this program was kind of, I did on my own, but I did it with all of these people like you behind me. It was an amazing experience. And what I did was I had a meeting. I used to go to a Cheney Road called Smokey Joe's. I was there every Tuesday, and I'd talk about how it felt not to have a cigarette. And I got fucking, they took me apart. You know, this is not, Nicotine Anonymous. You don't talk about that in here. And I said, well, I'll talk about anything I like if it's going to stop me from picking up. And that's the way I felt about it. I'd talk about anything I fucking like. And there was another lady, and they was talking about breast cancer. And who was going to shut her up? You know what I mean? It's like, I come here to tell you how I feel and what is frightening me and what has frightened me and what makes me feel good now and what I'm proud of. All of it. I tell you the lot. And I can start off by telling you that I'm in great discomfort today and tonight. I've been sober a while, but when I turned 70, the shit hit the fan physically, and I started to get back problems, and I'm 73 now. So for the last year, and what has happened is I've got this thing called peripheral neuropathy. Now, if anyone knows about that, it's a strange condition. It just means that my nerves are on full alert, and it's migratory. So most of the time it lives down here, and I have an ice pack on my leg, and I carry. I've got one here, got a bag full of disposable ones, and this is a controversial topic. I take medication, prescribed medication, because I'm in so much pain, it drives me crazy. And these things I take, pregabalin is one, and the drugs that they give to epileptics, and they suppress the nervous system. And I remember when I first was offered the option of taking these just under 3 years ago, I called my doctor and I said, I can't handle this. This is beyond anything I've ever experienced before. It's like having a blowtorch on my leg, 24 hours. And he said, well, try this, try these things. And he gave me, I don't know if it's appropriate, but I'm gonna tell you anyway, that he gave me 100 milligrams of this stuff. And I took it, and I just thought, well, I'm gonna try and see what it's like. And I fucking hated it, And my kids were going off to school, and I couldn't talk to them. And I just was, this is the worst place I've ever been, and it was, even including being the little boy crying in the playground. This thing of being in recovery for almost 30 years at that point in my life, I thought, how am I going to do this? What am I going to do? Because I either live in pain to the point where I actually consider topping myself, on the odd day. And I got a family I got to raise, and I got to be a good dad, and I got to be... I've got to have composure, And I've got to show an example to these kids and my friends and in recovery and everybody I know. They're actually, I'm not going to pick up or drink. I'm going to practice this program to best of my ability. So I took that on. And bit by bit, I became used to it. And I take medication now. And I'm not proud of it, but I say it because I know it, when I talk about it in the other fellowship, I get identification. And you know, people have said back to me, thank you. And a guy I knew down, I know in Guildford, and he had been away from these rooms for 3 years because someone had said to him, if you're taking medication, if you're on any kind of meds, you're not sober. And he stopped coming back. He stayed away. He had spina bifida. And he, when he came back, he was on crutches in great pain. And I did that chair the night he came back. I could not believe it. I talked about this stuff. And he talked about his predicament for the first time in 3 years and without judgment. And it may be, and I hope so, that some of our principles have been allowed to evolve to the point where I can tell you about this, because otherwise what the fuck would I do? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Where would I go? Because I got nowhere else to go. I don't have anywhere else to go. And I love that as much as it's difficult. I love that. But I hear you go, I hear you identify, and that it gives me so much hope and confidence, and it allows me to forgive myself. I remember 20 years ago being told that I had an underactive thyroid, and I had to take thyroxine or whatever it's called for the rest of my life, and I was so bitterly disappointed. I thought, and then I hear people in the room say, you know, I haven't had a drug or a powder or a drink for however long. I think, well, I don't know. I've got to be able to tell you this. And I've told you now that cat's out of the bag. It's been out for a while, actually. It's not something I keep a secret. And that is why I'm sober, because I'm here to tell you about it. And I don't pick up, I don't drink, I do not abuse this program in any way. And because I love it. I love it with all my heart. It came into my life many, many, many years ago, and I was confronted with my disease by a person who I'd abused the most, actually, funnily enough. He was a business manager who I had abused and hurled insults at and used as a clown and a muggins, and he took it all because he loved me, and he coached me through. He got me through all of the 70s, touring around the world, doing the most disgusting things you can think of, streaking. I would get on planes with a pair of overalls, nothing underneath, and just slip the shoulder off and be in first class and run back into economy with nothing on. And nobody threw me off the plane. You know, why was I not arrested? Not once was I ever taken aside. One time I have flown from the Bahamas to Miami to Tulsa to do an all-night gig with some my mates to celebrate the founding of a ballroom, Kane's Ballroom, and we were all going to jam there at 12 o'clock at night. So I headed out from the Bahamas to Miami, and I realized when I got on a plane that all I had was my passport. I didn't have anything else. I didn't think, you know, I didn't really give a shit. And I got off the plane in the Bahamas, and my visa had expired for the work visa for the States. They put me in a cell in the sort of the Latin part of it's fucking hilarious when I think about it. And I spent the overnight in the cell, and I was given a sort of paper visa to enter into the country, and I went on to this. This memorial thing, and I got pissed as a rat on the plane again. And when I got off, there was a policeman waiting for me at the bottom of the stairs. It's unbelievable, really. And he put me in the drunk tank. So I was in, and they wouldn't believe who I was and why I was there. I said, I'm going to play at this ballroom called Kane's Ballroom, and I've come all this way. And he said, yeah. I said, get me a guitar. If any of you know about folk music, there's a bloke called Huddy Ledbetter did exactly the same thing about 100 years ago and played his way out of a nick in Texas, and he'd murdered somebody. So I was in good stead, you know what I mean? I was in... it was another brotherhood that I entered into right there, and I managed to... I got a guitar. They went and got a guitar, and I played my way out of the nick, and I made it to the gig. I made it there, and that was it. And I stayed there a couple of days and went back. And I forgot to say, in that cell in Miami, I slept on the cot. And when I had a short sleeve shirt on, a beautiful old Ivy League cotton shirt, and it ripped all the way up the back. So the police person that took me to the immigration people to get a temporary visa, she took me to the Disney shop in the airport, and bought me a T-shirt, a Mickey Mouse T-shirt, which I then wore to go to the immigration people. I mean, this couldn't... you couldn't write this, you know? And that was kind of a daily occurrence, all in the life of a drunk, an addict, you know? It's been a while now, and... other than taking the meds, which I take for my condition, I haven't touched anything for over 30 years, and I'm so proud of that, and I love to hear that, because it's just there's so much power in that, and reinforcement. Thank you, and I'm so grateful for what I've got, and to be able to share it like this is such a privilege and an honour. And this night will be burned in my memory, although I've forgotten the last one. because my memory is fucked, to be honest with you. And I say, you know, proof of the pudding is, I'll say, that thing we did yesterday was really cool, don't you think? And they said, that was this morning, Dad. That's how bad it is. And unfortunately, I think it's probably going to get worse. And along with that, and I've lost my... And when Daniel was talking into that, I had the volume knob, I'm sure you noticed, but, you know, because it's my ear, I have tinnitus, chronic tinnitus, whistling, like you wouldn't believe, because I stood in front of things like that was tall as the traditions there, and they're gone, but at the time, I loved it, and I still do. I still play, and I'm playing in Hyde Park. If any of you want to go, you could stand on the Park Lane there and you'll hear it, because I play so fucking loud, and it will reach all the way into Green Park and whatever, and I guarantee you that, because they put everything through the PA, and I might use an amp that's only that big, but it gets through the PA, and I will be standing next to the amp without fail. And not just that, I like cymbals. I love big ride cymbals. You know, the ones that go like that. And I'll get next, as close as I can to these things. And by the time I got home, my ears are on fire. And I wouldn't have it any other way. And the only thing is that I can't hear you talk. I don't care much about it. I mean, I'll say what, and until I get it. But my love of music is another addiction, you know. It's my primary addiction, because before I could, I was old enough to be able to get into a pub or score, I got tuned in to stuff that I had was like music from outer space, and it saved my life on so many occasions, and it still does. I go there for comfort, for re-inspiration, and because I want to share that message. Same bloody thing. I do recognize that I'm a messenger. That's what I do. I don't have any problem. I don't like what I do very much. I just hope that someone might like it, because then I can say, well, it came from over there. And it's the same with this program. I'll tell you what I've been told. That's all I got to offer. My sponsor, first sponsor, who was a fantastic man in the local meetings in Guildford, he was called the Messiah. Can you believe that? I mean, and he would have, literally, it would be like the last, I'd go to the meeting, he'd be there, and it was like the Last Supper. He'd be there with all these acolytes, you know, I understood it, because they hung on every word. And he said to me, if you work this program to the best of your ability, it will be impossible for you to use or drink. I thought, well, that's a bit profound. You know, I didn't really, I believed him. I didn't really understand it, or, you know, mentally wasn't able to really comprehend, but I believed him. And that's been the other part of why I come here, because I believe it. I don't get it at all. And I've looked at the principles and the traditions and the steps. I've worked all the steps. I still don't know in my gut how that works, because I know me in here. And my stuff in here is so strong that if I don't come here for any length of time, and I mean days, if I'm not here for a week, I'm in trouble. And what will happen is I start being dishonest. I start to abuse the people that love me. I refuse to accept responsibility for anything that's going on. And it's all your fault. And I feel terrible and sorry for myself and angry and irritable and all the stuff, like a dry drunk, like they talk about. And I didn't even know that what that was until I got sober. And I just, once I'd got into my system the pattern of going to meetings, you know, on a weekly basis, three a week at least, I didn't know that there was such a thing, that if I stopped going, I would turn into this monster that was much worse than the drunk or the addict, because there was a sort of a depth to it that I never allowed before. I mean, you know, our previous speaker talked about that, you know, hating themselves, and I loathed myself, and the only way I could be comfortable was to get stoned or drunk, and I had no, there were no limits for me, because I had made money by the time I was 21, I had made a lot of money, and I was spending it all the time. I lived beyond my means, and I still do, all the time, and just spending. When it comes to money, here it goes, and I've got to go back to work to get a bit. You know, it's the same old story for me. It's nothing's changed, but you, what I was going to say was that it was no, I wasn't a binger. So maybe I was when I was a kid, and the first thing I did in drug terms was Benzedrine, and I used to get it in Seoul. I walked the streets of Seoul. I went to the Flamingo Club and the whiskey and the marquee and all night as I sleep on Charing Cross Station on the bench. And the thing was to do, for the weekend, you take a Black Benny. It was a little capsule, and that would get me wired for 24 hours. And I loved it. And that used to work with the booze. You know, I would take Speed with Mackeson or Guinness. Can you imagine? I mean, what a wonderful cocktail. And then I would go on to, what else would it be? We go on to rum and black, you know, at the end of the evening, you know, or gin and orange, and throw up without fail every night and fall in love with the mayor's daughter and go round her house and shout at the window and then be completely sent to Coventry for days and days and then wheedle my way back in. And my passport was my guitar, isn't that funny? And I played in pubs for drink. So I never bought a drink. When I started playing the guitar, I never had to buy a drink. I'd play a couple of Big Bill Brunsey songs or Ray Rowe Bill or a Lead Belly song, Good Night Irene. And a beer would appear in front of me, pint of director's bitter. And that would be it. And this may have been part of why I ended up here. It's possible. And also, you know, the street stuff, which was actually, on the face of it, was pretty harmless. And it was then that I was sort of weekending. And then, you know, I got a few good gigs. And believe it or not, all this stuff went into the background. And I became a student and an addict of music. And for about 3 years, that's all I did all day long. And most of the night was listen to music and try to copy it and try to absorb what it was about and figure out who was the best and what they could do. And could I do that? And, I persevered. And at the end of that, I fell into, you know, I fell into bed with a couple of blokes who were just bang at it the whole fucking time. And this was 67, 68. And our drummer used to say, if I ever catch you with a fucking needle, I'll break your legs. And he meant it, although he was mainlining himself the whole time. And I know why, because he loved me. He loved me dearly, and I love him. And we still love one another. I can't go near him because he's still at it. And, he's a tough, tough man, and maybe he can handle it. I couldn't. But nevertheless, I went out. Isn't that funny? You know, I've been close up. We did Top of the Pops, I remember, in 68, something like 6, no, 67. And at the end of the show, he was taken out on a stretcher. Dying, blue, he'd OD'd, you know, on Top of the fucking Pops. Can you imagine someone OD'ing? And this again was a frequent thing, you know, that we toured all over England, this band, and was three of us. But most of the time it was two of us, because one of them, and never me, I take my word, I swear on the Bible, never me, one of the others. I know it sounds like it's bullshit, but one of the others will either be in an ambulance or, you know, passed out in his own vomit. And I thought, I'm never going to be like this. I am never, ever going to be. You'll never catch me, you know. Although we'd already done it. I'd spent, you know, night after night throwing up and trying to get hold of the mayor's daughter, and it didn't. So, and then, but full circle, by the time I was 30, I was in the fucking drain, you know. I was just going down with everything a man could want, everything anyone would offer you, you know, money, fame, a beautiful wife, friends, and most of those friends actually would have meetings to talk about me, like little committee meetings to say, why is he trying to kill himself? He's got we love him, we stand by him, we support him, and he still wants to die, and he's trying to kill himself, and what are we going to do? And nobody knew what to do until this manager came out and said, you know, you've got a drink problem and you're going to die. And I thought, well, and I got to this point where my little paraphernalia was a gram or two of coke, a bottle of vodka, a guitar and a shotgun and a tape machine. And I would, and the guitar, and I had cartridges, you know. I'd put them in, I'd close it, I'd open it, I'd play a song, and turn out the record on, and I'd have a drink, and I'd do some blow. I mean, it was just an amazing little circuitry of stuff that were going, with a beautiful wife asleep in bed, or laying there worrying, more like it. And I thought, well, you know, why not? Why fucking not? And I thought, how would you do it? You'd have a, you know, thumb in the on the chair. And I thought, well, if I do that, I won't be able to drink and use anymore. What's weighed up? and I put the gun down, and then, you know, I'd put it away, because it was much more important to me to come to in the dark, not knowing whether it was day or night, I mean, or whether it was morning or evening or afternoon, and go looking in the cellar for a bottle, or, you know, combing the carpet. I'm sure you, when I had a lot of money to begin with, I asked this interior designer to make a carpet out of sheepskin, long-haired sheepskin. And I didn't really think it through, because when I started using, I used to do smack that I bought in Gerrard Street, and it was called White Elephant, and I'd grind it up with a mortar and pestle, whatever, and do it like that. Now, those of you that mainlined will be astonished by how fucking wasteful I was, because I'd go through a gram in a day and a half. I mean, just, and I'd do it, and I'd think, when was the last time I did it? When was the last one? And I'd have another one about half an hour later. And it didn't make any difference, because I'd gone into the nod, and I just can't do it until it was all gone. And then my girlfriend, is the other twist to the story, would go to Ladbroke Grove and buy Jacks from a registered addict who would sell his prescription. And that, you know, kept me alive. And all of this led up to this thing, where I just thought, well, you know, I am in trouble. I am in serious trouble. And I called the guy. Look at this, we're fucking flying through the time, and I haven't even got to my sobriety yet. And he said, right, you pack a bag, and off I went to Hazelden in America, near Minnesota. And in the middle of nowhere, snow, 30 below, you know, zero, and I got straight, and I was in a unit with about 28 people, men. We knew how to fraternize with the women, so we all went off. They know it's like all going on, and I don't know how we ever got away with it, or probably we didn't. But and I came back, and I was assigned a sponsor by a couple of people. It's like five, okay, and I went out again because I didn't like the sponsor. I didn't like meters. I wasn't like you, and I, you know, I wanted to drink. I wanted to use, and I went out. I was out for 4 years, I think, and I tried doing it socially. I tried doing a bit of blow. Nothing worked, and so I went out and bought a crate of vodka and got. And while I was drinking that, I thought about. I went back into treatment. That was 30 years ago, and in treatment, this is the crux of it, really, for me. Is that in treatment, with a week to go, I knew I was fucked again. I was back in treatment, second time, doing absolutely, having no effect whatsoever. And in my living room, I got on my knees and I asked for help. And I might have used the word God. I probably did, because that, I'm a kind of lapsed Christian and, you know, brought up that way. And from that day till now, I have not thought of anything of that nature. Anything that, you know, that could get me high, and that's a fucking miracle in my book. And I left that room from being on my knees back to the unit where I sat and drank coffee and was silly, and I felt this weird sensation, which I found out later, or someone told me, was happiness. And I hadn't felt that for a long, long time, and I was happy. And I knew about pleasure, and I thought that was happiness. And I knew how to create pleasure, but I couldn't create happiness. And I think at some point during my drinking career, drugging career, that I thought happiness was not necessarily part of the picture. That people weren't meant to be happy. You know what I mean? It was something that just like would a roll of the dice. And I don't use the word luck in recovery. I don't think. I believe I don't have anything. I mean, I don't like to hear when, well, I, you know, it's everyone said it out there, it's not my business. But when someone says I'm lucky to be here, I think, because that's too like playing blackjack to me. You know, you turn over a card and you've got a three of spades or an ace. And this is different to me. This is about prayer, meditation, and a belief in a higher power and fellowship. Absolutely down to the bottom, fellowship. Because if I did all the other stuff, but I didn't come to meetings, I wouldn't be. I'd get drunk. I'd get stoned. I would get. I don't know what I'd do. I don't think I'd die because I love getting stoned so much that I wouldn't put that at risk. You know, if I was going to go out, I'd go out big time, and I don't know if I'd come back. I probably would. You know, I probably would because all of you are here. My friends are here. And I can't live without that, really. You know, I bring up my family. I love my wife. My wife's in recovery. And life is great. Life is fantastic. Even with the fucking pain, I wouldn't... And I think that's my message. That, you know, you can do this. And I lost someone I love very much, a little boy. And I didn't drink. And I didn't use. I went to meetings every day, three times a day. And people used to say, talk about that. Talk about it, talk about it, talk about it. And I talked about it, and people would come up and say, you just took away my last excuse to drink, to use. And I thought, okay, that's what this is all about. So I tell you, that, you know, this thing migrates. I lie in bed and it's up here, like blowtorch up here. I go, hey, what is it? It's just pain. But I'm sober. And I thank you for asking me.